So I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to address this, in fact, to start this conference. And also apologize to those who heard some bits of this talk before. It's an overview, it's maybe. So first I would like to say that it will be foolish for me to speculate about the physics in this gathering, so I'll just stick strictly to mathematics. And even though there are many physical speculations or proposals, I'd say, around. So, so broadly, the area of this where the... is that in focus? The object of interest for us is the enumerative geometry of curves and threefolds, and specifically higher genus curves. So a typical question I want to ask is how many curves of given degree and genus satisfy such and such geometric conditions, such as, you know, pass through given points of a threefold or meet some other cycles of some other dimension. And like, for example, how many, you know, rational curves in P3 pass through so many points? That's a typical question. And the way to set up the enumerative problems, so there's, so to speak, there are two points of view here. If you have a, here's a, in fact, a picture of the real locus of what you picture, you see it's a real locus of some degree 4 curves in P3, and it's just genus 0, hence unnoted. There are two ways to, if you have a curve in threefold, there are two points of view on this curve. Maybe I'll use the laser pointer instead. Okay, so there's there are two points of view on the curve in threefold. One can either imagine that this is a parametrized curve, meaning there's an abstract curve and a map to your threefold. Or the other way, another way to define a curve in threefold is to describe it. So the way this is plotted, this particular thing is plotted, I've taken just explicit parametrization of this curve and asked the computer to plot this. But I could have, instead of parametrization, in Maple, if you use plot, this is parametrized curve. If you use implicit plot, this is curve defined by equations. Right. So another way to, you know, so you can, instead of parameterization, you can think about equations. You know why it's taking so long. So equations of a curve, whether this mathematical, is just ideal shape on your threefold. Right? So, you know, it's local in any chart, curve is defined by ideal of all polynomials that vanish on it. Okay? And there's this double life of a curve. In fact, in any, so far the fact that it's a threefold or it's a curve didn't play any specific role. So, but we'll get to that later. And there's, so to speak, two points. When it's a smooth, it's a nice smooth object like this, there's these two points of view are obviously equivalent. But if we want to compactify the problem, we include all the different degenerate contribution, then of course this two, the natural compactification of the moduli spaces you construct from this are drastically different. And of course there'll be, many of you will be surprised to see the definition of the moduli space of stable maps in this lecture, but nonetheless I recall it. What the definition of the moduli space of stable maps is the compactification you obtain from the point of view of parametrized curves. What you allow is you allow degeneration of the domain of the map. And so the kind of degeneration you allow is the nodal degenerations, like this, something like this. Right, so that's a... Okay, when I say that F is a map of a certain degree H2, it means that the push forward of the fundamental class of this Riemann surface under the map F is a given homology class of X. And there are certain identification here. The identification is that if we don't care when we talk about, we actually care about curves in threefold, so we don't care about the way it's actually parameterized, so we allow a quotient out by all possible reparameterization of the domain. And the condition that this quotient to be sensible is the stability condition. We impose the fact that the group of automorphism that is a reparameterization that, the automorphism, this group should be finite. And the presence of this finite group of automorphisms is what makes the few slides later, that will make the Gromov-Witten invariant the rational numbers. And we also somehow, is a technical point, will allow disconnected domains. I presume most of you have seen this construction 1 million times before or more. Now, if you think about ideals, there is an even more classical object that is called the Hilbert scheme. And what it is, by assumption, our X was a projective algebraic variety, so it sits in some projective space of sufficiently high dimension. And so curve sits in here, and so in particular, the ideal of this curve is a graded ideal in the homogeneous coordinate ring of this projective space. Right, so in other words, we look at the all polynomials in this n plus 1 variables that vanish on the curve. And this object, like I said, is graded by the degree of the polynomial. So the theorem of Hilbert says that for all sufficiently high degrees, the codimension of this space is, well, since it's a curve, it will be a linear. So in general, it's a polynomial in D. Since it's a curve, it's in fact a linear function of D. And the slope of this function is intersection of the homology class of the curve with the hyperplane section, and the intercept is, I'm actually getting ahead of myself. So the slope is, you have to take the homology class of the curve intersect with the hyperplane, and the constant term is the holomorphic quadratic characteristic, which is for a smooth curve 1 minus g. And so now to construct the somehow natural complexification here is just you just take all possible ideals with given Hilbert polynomial. So this is, this linear function of D is called Hilbert polynomial. That's the content of the Hilbert theorem, that it's a polynomial. And if you take them all, this is the Hilbert scheme. And by definition, it just cut out, it's cut out for you in some Grassmannian by certain natural equation. So it's some very natural object. However, So my next slide says that if you actually look at this varieties, then they can be barely singular. And in fact, this is especially true of the Hilbert scheme. So the referee for one of the papers on the subject complained that we're bringing Hilbert's scheme back from the dead because it's somehow, the singularities of the Hilbert scheme are so bad that, we should just forget the Hilbert scheme and just work with stable maps. And then just, But using Hilbert scheme has its advantages, as we'll see later. Right. I read your paper, yeah. But it's, but it's somehow it's abstractly, right? If you, for example, want to know for say something like, degree zero maps to P3, then it's sort of reasonable space, right? But even in the simplest case, say degree zero curves in P3, just point in P3, nobody knows how many, what's the dimension of that space, or how many connected, reducible components it has. So it's a, even, there's no even conjecture what the dimension of the actual space is. So, the very basic If you actually want to examine the geometry of the Hilbert scheme, the very basic questions are seem to be out of reach. And I also should point out that, as far as I know, there seem to be no. Of course, if you have a smooth curve, well, it's a, you know, it lives this double life, as I've indicated one of the first transparencies. But as far as the compactification goes, there seem to be no relation whatsoever between the two compactifications. And the simplest way to see it is in degree zero, because in degree zero, on the one hand, you get this Dillon-Mumford space, which we understand pretty well. On the other hand, you get the punctual Hilbert, I mean, the Hilbert scheme of points, and that's an object, like I just said, you know, two sentences ago, it's some very bad object. I mean, some very problematic object. However, both spaces have a fundamental good feature, and in that is they have a virtual fundamental class. The dimension of this virtual fundamental class is it's a very important for the whole correspondence to work. It's extremely important that this dimension is independent of the genus. It's the virtual dimension is just take minus the intersection of the degree of the curve with the canonical class of X. On stable maps, this is the work of Lee and Tian and Berendt and Fanteke to construct this virtual fundamental class. And on the Hilbert scheme side, it's done by Richard Thomas. And so the case of curves in threefolds becomes really special. So for example, here it's extremely for the Hilbert scheme construction to work. It's extremely just the beginning of the whole story that dimension is three, because then this third duality cuts down. The virtual class here is constructed from X groups from the ideal shift to itself, and it's extremely important. Then there's by third duality, the interesting X groups are only just first and the second, and similarly, like I said, in Grom-Witten's theory, this virtual class exists always, but it's only in dimension three. It's independent. The dimension is independent of the genus. And for any sort of correspondence to work, it has to be the case that this does depend on the genus. So now I'll review the. Again, this is something you've seen many times before, but since I want a comparison with Donaldson and Thomas invariants, let's just review how it's defined. So how do you define a Grom-Witten theory, the virtual number of curves passing through given cycles? What you do is you pick your cycles, so there's some cycles in X, and if you have a cycle of codimension, some codimension, that passing through it imposes so many constraints on a curve. So you take some of these constraints should be equal to the virtual dimension, and then what you can do, you take the you take this moduli space of actually on the previous slide it was a lie. There's this plus n here, but you know I think the experts are so right here. There should be plus n. That was the virtual dimension from the zero-pointed space. So you take. You interpret passing through cycles as the pullback via the, so there's this evaluation map from the moduli, from the stable map moduli space to X, and you passing through cycle gamma, you interpret as a pullback via this evaluation map of the Poincaré dual to gamma I. And then you just integrate this against the virtual fundamental class. Out comes a rational number, which you, like I said, because the rational number is because of the, well, there's objects with finite automorphisms. And so this is the Grom-Witten count of the number of curves passing through given cycles. Now, on Donaldson Thomas' side, there is no sensible way to define marked points. However, there is this universal object. If you take the Hilbert scheme cross X, then on that leaves this universal sheaf, that is the you know, such that, well, right. It's just universal idea should live on that. And since it's flat over this, then this object is in principle is singular, but because of flatness, it has characteristic classes. And in particular, there is C2, which C2 is supposed to interpret, the C2 of that object is supposed to interpret as the homology, the class of, so to speak, universal curve. And then if you take, right, I mean, sort of, you know, this universal ideal should define for you, so to speak, universal curve. And see that, but in homology, you say that that's the C2 of the universal sheaf. And then if you pick the Kunit component, the Kunit decomposition of this class, this class is here, that the homological meaning is passing through a given cycle in X. So you define now, so finally, you define this Donaldson Thomas invariant as the integral against this virtual fundamental class of this Kunis components of the C2 of the universal sheaf. And since there are no finite quotient problems, these are in fact are integers. And then you know ahead of time, then therefore they're not equal to, there's no way this Donaldson Thomas count of curves can be equal to Gromm-Witten count of curves, because, you know, ones are integers and the other are definitely not. In simple examples, you see they have big denominators. So there's something more complicated, the relation between the two, and to say that, I'll use the generating function, and this is the first instance where I'll use the fact that this diversity dimension independent of the genus, and then the Gromm-Witten side, I can just fix the cycles gamma 1 through gamma n, and sum over all genera of the Gromm-Witten invariant with the weight which is remembers the genus. So U will be my genus expansion parameters raised to the power 2 g minus 2, and so I sum over all genera. And just to get things, make things a little simple, I define the reduced partition function by just dividing out the degree zero part. In degree zero part, its virtual dimension is zero, so I can, you know, there's no insertion here, empty set. And this part is known explicitly for any threefold. So this reduced partition function is here for simplicity, because this division removes, if you have just components that totally, I mean, this counts. This counts, so to speak, components that are totally collapsed by the map F. And then on the Gromm-Witten, on the Donaldson-Thomas side, I use the same principle, except that I want to replace this. I mean, instead of summation over all genera, I'm summing over all Euler characteristics, and instead of 2 u to the 2g minus 2, I'm putting q to the chi.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So if I'm thinking straight, then this is the exponential.
Right. That's the exponential of the connector sink. Yeah. This is why I call it Z.
Yeah.
So the main conjecture is the following. This is the main conjecture, that this reduced partition function is, first of all, it's a rational function of the parameter Q. It's defined, in fact, what was defined as a formal power series is, in fact, defined in the entire complex plane of values of Q. And if I make the following substitution, then that's equal to the Gromm-Witten count. So you can imagine there is this there's one function z. This is a complex plane of the Riemann sphere of Q. There's Q equals zero, and there's Q equals, well, strictly speaking, minus one, and so there's one function, you expand it around this point, you get Donaldson Thomas, you extend it around this point, you get Gromovitz. And you expand it around infinity, you get the Dalton-Thomas again, because see the way Gromovitz theory is defined, because it's symmetric with respect to u goes to minus u, because it's only even powers of u enter here. And in particular, this is somehow, this is okay, because otherwise we'd have this kind of problem with Galois action on this imaginary unit. And so this thing is therefore also symmetric with respect to q goes to 1 over q, so it relates 0 and infinity. Okay, well, that's the conjecture. And the known cases are, there are some sporadic cases known, but systematically what's known is, first of all, if you take the original somehow case, is that if you take canonical bundle of a smooth toric surface, that's a toric Calabi-Yau, local toric Calabi-Yau, by combining the localization, the Dalton-Thomas localization done in here, plus this, the sort of box counting interpretation of the topological vertex done in here, I'll talk about this later, plus the evaluation, the proof of the topological vertex in the two-leg case done in here, then you get a proof. And also it's known in for any rank, so this is for any rank two, I mean, not necessarily Calabi-Yau, any rank two bundle over a smooth curve, then by combining the result of Jim with Rahul with something we've yet to finish writing, you get a proof that this is actually works. And in fact, it works in a sort of refined sense, because here this is independent of the localization parameters, because it's Calabi-Yau, but this here is working refined sense, first noticed by Jim and Rahul, that actually if you have a non-compact thing, then this guy's works as functions, they're equal as functions in equivariant parameters. Okay, well, I'm not going to talk about any of this proof, there are more conjectures. There are descendant Gromovitz theory, there are descendant invariants, I'm not going to go about this. I'm not going to go into how you define them in Gromovitz story, but I will tell you what they conjecturally correspond to on the Dalton-Thomas side. And this, of course, so far we've used C2 of the universal shift, but in fact the universal shift has all of its characteristic classes are in fact non-trivial. And we can take any of them and pick any of the Kunit components of that class. And so, for example, we conjecture that the kth descendant of a point corresponds to the k plus second component of the Chern character of this universal sheaf, provided there are the codimension of all other insertions are positive. Because you see, in Gromovitz, in Dalton-Thomas theory, the insertions coexist peacefully. In Gromovitz theory, they don't. Because if you one mark point, so to speak, hits another, then the moduli space changes at that point. And so insertions in Gromovitz theory, so to speak, interact. And so it's important that there are no... example of that is the Virasoro, right? The way insertions interact. And so this is important. And aside from sporadic checks, the principal evidence for this comes from the considering equivariant theory of P1 cross C2, that's a threefold, with opposite weights on C2. If you do this, then the Hodge integrals in question cancel out, and you lift the Gromovitz theory of P1. So it will be, this conjecture specializes to what we've proven about Gromovitz theory of curves. Right. I mean, yeah, sure. this formula in terms of this you know, the completed the Gromov-Witten-Hurwitz correspondence is a special case of Gromov-Witten-Donaldson Thomas if you take this. So there's also a relative version, and in fact it's somehow easier to explain what it is, but I'll just, in the interest of time, I'll skip it, and I only want to say that the relative dominant, this is the work of Jun Li to define this. So in fact those local theory of curves, it's actually, you know, that works in this in relative context. So in the rest of the talk, we will explore what this conjecture says in the particular case of Gromov-Witten of a toric threefold. And why I need a toric threefold? Because I want to do a TA boat. I want to do equivariant localization. And this is a well-known, somehow it's been around this approach for a while. And on the Hilbert-Skin side, it was used by Alan Guttenstrome a long time ago, and then on the stable map site, Kintsevich did it, and then there's a general theory of Graeber and Pandrian that applies to virtual localization in either case. So, however, what you get out of equivariant localization is very different on Gromov-Witten side and Donaldson-Thomas side, because as you probably know, the Gromov-Witten invariant, the localizing Gromov-Witten invariant in k dimensions leads you to k-fold Hodge integrals. In this case, you get triple Hodge integrals, and this is, you know, I guess that's a polite way of saying that we don't know so terribly much about them, and we would like to know more. So, I don't know, if you decide to come on Wednesday for Wednesday talk, maybe you'll get some appreciation for the complexity of the subject. But by context on the Donaldson Thomas side, the torus fixed points are in fact isolated. And so localization gives you in fact finite sum. So this is this is good, right? And how they are, what the fixed points loci look on the Donaldson Thomas side? Maybe I'll start with the warm up, which many of you will be offended to see something like this, but why don't we start with some very simple case, namely Hilbert scheme of just points Hilbert scheme of curves in C2. Now it's a very simple thing. A curve of degree d curve in C2 is, well, it's ideal, is such that it's just ideal in polynomials in two variables, such that it's, if I take polynomials of degree at most k, the for all sufficiently large k, this space is Hodge dimension dk plus n. When is the, so to speak, well, n is my, and well, anyway, n is number. So right, so, and then the torus satisfaction in this and any other case is extremely explicit. You just, it acts by just rescaling x and y. And of course, if you, the space of polynomials in x and y, just monomials are the eigen vectors of this action. And in fact, they all have distinct eigenvalues. So whenever I have a torus fixed ideal, you know, a torus fixed point on this Hilbert scheme of curves in C2 is an ideal. That is fixed by the action of the torus. It has to be spent by monomials. And how an ideal looks like? It looks something like this. So you just, here's the list of all possible monomials. And, you know, I don't see, look, I'm sorry you can't see the color. Well, there's on my display, there's subtle color difference between something here and there. But, but I guess you can use your imagination. Imagine that this is, so here in my computer, this part is colored yellow, and this is left white, but I guess this legend is kind of useless. So anyway, with any monomial like this one, since it's an ideal, all everybody in this, everybody here will be in the ideal, right? And so the monomials in the ideal will form this kind of staircase shape, right? That's some kind of staircase, and the corners are the generators. And then, okay? And then going back to the definition of the Hilbert scheme, you see, we were supposed to look at the polynomial such that if I look at the codimension, take some degree and look at the codimension of the polynomials, degree at most k, that should be a linear function with d the slope and n the intercept. Then, so what in this picture means that I suppose if I take a certain degree like this, then the number of polynomials not in the ideal should be, the number of polynomials outside of this right line should be this linear function of how far I'm gonna from this corner. And it's obvious that the slope of this function is the total width of these infinite rows and columns, in this case two. And the constant term is, so to speak, area only renormalized, because there's a so in this case it'll be 9. Okay. So if you now do now, in fact, I'm interested in the threefolds rather than surfaces, but still in the threefold the picture is the same, only three dimensional. So this is how, if I look at the Tor 6 points. Now Hilbert scheme, this object Hilp C3 D chi, it's the ideals now in a ring of polynomials of three variables and three dimensional torus acts on this, and it's just the same as before, only now the partitions are three dimensional, so something like this. They may have this infinite rows and columns, or we call them legs now. And then the degree is the total cross section of all these legs. So in this case, I have to add 5, 5, and 4, which makes 14. And chi is the renormalized volume. So strictly speaking, the volume of this object is infinite. But if I define the volume as the constant term in this Hilbert function, then it's well defined. And now to get a general Turek threefold is glued out of this C3 patches. And so what you're supposed to do is you take this Turek combinatorics the way your threefold is glued out of C3s, then assemble such a 3D partition according to the Turek combinatorics. And here's, for example, an example for P1 cubed. So this is why I drew a cube. So, you take the one skeleton of the moment polytope, and you put that's a certain graph, which would be a cube graph for P1 cubed. Then you place a 3D partition with possibly infinite leg at every vertex, and you make sure that the infinite legs glue together along the edges. That's the data that specifies a torus fixed point. And now the degree is it comes from the degree tells you what the cross section of the edges can be, and the constant terms tells you what the how many how many boxes you're allowed to put at the vertices, and so that's that gives you a finite, albeit large, number of fixed points in the Hilbert scheme. Okay. Well, so there is this elementary yet yet important duality in mathematics, and that's the duality between half full bottle and half empty bottle, and so and by just taking the complement of the picture so on the previous slide, you get a picture like this, which looks like a dissolving crystal, meaning like, you know, if, like a sugar cube or you know, maybe sugar cube, it's a good example. But however, in this, in particular, you see in this kind of, in this picture, just a word, you know, so that you don't take it too literally, the edge lengths here don't have much intrinsic meaning. They only come as some, if we were to sum over all degree from this kind of big Gromov-Witten generating function, then this edge length would have some generating function meaning, but they don't have, you know, the length of this edge is not a number. It's supposed to be formally viewed infinite, or not infinite, but somehow larger than every other parameter in the series. So it's supposed to be, we'll be, from the statistical physics point of view, we'll be thinking about the situation where the size of the crystal is much larger than the size of the dissolution at the corner. So it means it's a very, very large piece of sugar in your cup of tea. But yeah, this whole talk is made by computer, yeah. Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, look, it's no, I'll show you some pictures that are just photographs. So, where was I? Yeah. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that, you see, what's a covariant localization? A covariant localization is gives you sum over fixed points. In other case, here you'll be summing over all possible dissolution configuration of a crystal. Means you'll be summing, you know, partition function of this. On the statistical mechanical system. And in fact, it's kind of useful point of view. Right, so we'll get to that later. So, but it's a sum with a certain weight, right? So this is, so far we only considered configurations. And now we'll go to the weight. Localization, you're not summing just, you sum something. So this is the set over which we sum. And now we'll go to the weight with which we sum. So the localization weight is has this, not only the index set has this statistical mechanical thing, statistical mechanical interpretation, but in fact the localization weight has a statistical mechanical interpretation, and that goes like this. So this is a similar formula we computed in that paper from, you know, there's a general virtual localization. But then you have to apply to a given case to get a formula, and that's what this is what you get. First, so let me just remind you briefly what's the general shape of the weight in Gibbs distribution? Is that so? I have my crystal, which is looks like this. So you sum. First of all, you sum. There's a fugacity factor which controls the number of atoms or the numbers of molecules, the numbers of particles in the system. And in this case, it's the volume, and I mean the number of these boxes. And it's like I said, it's so to speak infinite, but up to some regularization, that's chi. So there's a factor of minus q to the chi, which makes interpretation, makes minus q to be fugacity. So this is this minus Q to the chi. And then there is a product of interaction energy between any possible atom. I mean, any pair of atoms. I mean, any pair of those boxes. So this is constructed out of a whole bunch of many boxes, of little boxes. So it'll be a product over all of them. And in fact, this product, of course, should be regularized, otherwise it'll just badly diverge. But, you know, we're not going to go into how it's regularized, but the product over every pair of boxes of some function. Well, in this case, let's look at the complement of a finite partition, right? So, I mean, this particular formula, you can think that I'm looking at the complement of something like this, I mean, without the infinite legs. Then it's, but in fact, it makes sense for something like this too, only regularization is a little, you know, more subtle. So on the level that we're right now, let's just imagine that we've taken the product over all pairs of boxes in the crystal, that's, so to speak, infinite, and you multiply one and the same function of these two things, and so in normal statistical mechanics, that would be exponential of you know, minus Boltzmann constant times temperature over, you know, divided, I don't know, which might, you know, some kind of, let's see, k beta, yeah, it's 1 over temperature, right? Right, so it's a normal statistical mechanics, would be minus Boltzmann constant over temperature times the interaction energy of the two things. But so what this function is, this function, well, it's it has to depend on equivariant parameters. So maybe it's best to read it backwards. So first of all, there are equivariant parameters in the theory, since we're talking about the torus section. So the weight of the torus will be denoted by T1, T2, and T3. And these three numbers give it a distinguished linear function on V3, which is just, you know, the linear function with this coefficient. Its value in the box with coordinates I, J, and K is, well, it's this. And if I have two boxes, I can form this, the difference of the two, and I have of the value of this linear function. And if I now I can plug it in here, we'll get something. Now, whatever it is, it's you know, some kind of translation invariant interaction thing between two boxes. In fact, this particular potential has some nice features, but I'm not. Pretty much the only thing I want to two things I want to say about this. First of all, it's a rational function of equivariant parameters, and second, if the equivariant parameter happen to sum to zero, then something magic happens. If the equivariant parameter sum to zero, that's the Calabi-Yau case, then the product of the interaction of the, you know, box A with box B, and then the other way around, will be just one. And so in this particular case, this whole product is just not there. And we get just uniform measure on configuration with given volume. So so that tells you that this case is probably a lot simpler than the general case, and it's in geometric. It's meaning in geometry that's the Calabi-Yau case. Okay. So generally, if I want to. If I want to localize on a general toric threefold, then by solving this, that the answer will be the building block in the answer is the following function of three ordinary partitions. You know, let's call them lambda, mu, and nu. So I take I'll take this lambda mu and nu, and then consider all three-dimensional partitions, then end on this 3. Right, so this means, so this is the sum over all 3D partitions with possibly infinite legs, but such that asymptotic cross-sections are these three given partitions, lambda, mu, and nu. And I sum over all 3D partitions with this asymptotic condition of my wave function, which I sort of described for you. This will be a function now, this result will be a function of the of variables q, t1, t2, and t3, and these three partitions. And it's clear that a general, if I know this function, I can localize on any toric threefold. I can localize this primary Donaldson Thomas invariance. I can localize on any toric threefold. So, what? Oh, sorry. So there's another function, there's a similar function in Gram-Witten theory, but depends on three partitions, three parameters, and a genus parameter. That's something you can construct from general triple Hodge integrals. That's what comes into localization. If you localize in Gram-Witten theory, you'll get a similar function, and conjecturally related. And this is we can prove it in the one leg case. That's a pretty delicate function, I must say. Even in one leg case, in the non Calabi-Yau case, it's a very delicate function. Two partitions empty, right? Yeah, one is not. And then already there, in my other talk, I'll talk a little bit about this function. It's a very delicate function. In general, non Calabi-Yau case. But in Calabi-Yau case, it specializes since in the Calabi-Yau case, this whole localization weight just goes away aside from q to the volume. And in that case, it's a much simpler function. And it's been remarked, it's sort of remarked in this, in here, that it specializes to the topological vertex of, I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about topological vertex in this conference. And in this particular case, the relation to Hodge integral is known up to 2 legs. And there are some combinatorial challenges. You can view it as a combinatorial challenge to extend to 3 legs. But you can also view it as a geometric challenge. So now going back to the statistical mechanical interpretation, the Gram-Witten Donaldson Thomas conjecture says that this minus q that we identified as fugacity, meaning the cost of the parameter that measures the cost of removing or adding an atom to a system, is in fact exponential of the genus expansion variable in Gram-Witten theory. The genus expansion in Gram-Witten theory is concerned with expansion of the partition function around the point u equals 0. Right? So this is q equals minus 1 means u equals 0. And in this case, the fugacity goes to 1. It means that the cost of adding, removing an atom from the system is goes to 0. And so in other words, this IU is the chemical, that's the chemical potential. And so what happens in this case is what's called thermodynamic limit, namely since removing an atom from the system costs you nothing, then infinitely many will be removed. And so you get to go to a different scaling to see what happens. So from this kind of from this picture on which we can see the defined structure, means individual atoms, you're going to go to the macroscopic picture. So, I mean, the actual crystals you observe in nature, you can't see the individual atom on them. So, what mathematically speaking is that this, what limit shape means is that from a measure on, you take a finite probability measure on this kind of piecewise linear surfaces, you rescale it, and then it converges to a delta measure on some continuous surface. Right? So from things like this, you go to things like that. And then what the emergence of this limit shape, the limit shape is the this summation, the precision function, totally dominated by the limit shape, and every term in the expansion of the precision function in this parameter U is just order by order fluctuations around the limit shape. It's sort of like, I mean, if you haven't seen it before, it's a little bit like, it is like computing asymptotics of integral by Laplace's method. If you compute the asymptotic of integral, there'll be one point that determines. Here we're doing some kind of, I mean, this is integral over infinite dimensional space, so instead of one point, will be, one surface that determines the asymptotics. And then the every term in the Laplace asymptotics is determined by suitable derivatives of your function at that one critical point, and that means every term of this precision function expansion is determined by suitable order of fluctuations around the limit shape. So because I'm kind of intuitive feeling what the limit shape business means, I'll just show you a picture. If I take a very, very large, say, a very, very large just finite 3D partition, then this probability 1 is going to look like this. So there's if your computer produces you a random 3D partition of a large size, and of course, the fine details of what you can see will be different from looking from far away. You always see one and the same thing. You'll see there's this particular shape. Unless you wrote the wrong code for for producing your random partition. And so what I'm trying to say is that the mathematical statement here is that if I take a measure on 3D partition that gives weight Q to the volume to a partition to some given partition, and then let maybe minus Q to the volume, then let this weight go to 1, then after rescaling by the cube root of expected volume, I'll see one and the same in the limit. I'll see there'll be the flow of large numbers. I see one and the same surface. And what the surface is it's a subject for another talk. It's this what's called Ronking function of one of the simplest algebraic objects, the straight line in the plane. But so the straight line of the plane, you in fact can recognize as the Hoare-Waffle mirror of C3. And in fact, quite generally, if you take local toric collabiaux, these limit shapes are their Hoare-Waffle mirrors. And so, in particular, this is an observation, first, as far as I can show, the first time this phenomenon was observed was in paper with Nikita, when we observed that In supersymmetric gauge theory, what happens is that there's a similar localization story on the instanton moduli spaces, and there is some kind of geometric image, usual 2D partitions that that occur in there, and then the limit, this limit in which one is supposed to find the Zeiber-Quinton solution corresponds to thermodynamics of thermodynamics in this random partition ensemble, and what at the limit shape one gets this the Zeiber-Quinton curve. It's supposed to, you know, describes you the effective low energy behavior of the theory. Via geometric engineering, that's now a subcase in here. And that the sort of I think it's a intriguing question, at least intriguing question for me to know to what extent one can such a probabilistic interpretation of the mirror phenomenon. In how many cases, whether in any other cases one can find a probabilistic interpretation of the mirror phenomenon, meaning that you start with some, you know, problem about the manifold X, you write as a statistical mechanical problem, you find the limit shape in that problem, and the limit shape is essentially your mirror. This is I don't know when I'm started, but this is a good time to stop anyway. So.